Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, we feature two great female directors, Jill Carter and Catherine Legg. Jill Carter is one of the directors involved in the new series, The Murders, which premiered on March the 25th, and Catherine Legg is the director of the great documentary, Met While Incarcerated, which premieres tonight on the documentary channel. My first guest is Jill Carter, who has worked as a writer, director, producer, and as a script supervisor on a host of film and television projects, which include La Femme Nikita, Due South, Total Recall 2070, Who is Cletus Tout, True Confessions, Full Court Miracle, Adventure Inc., the great Canadian film Saint Ralph, It's a Boy Girl Thing, The Best Years, Aaron Stone, Adam McGoin's Chloe, Score, a hockey musical, Rookie Blue, The Firm, and Beauty and the Beast. As a director, she has worked on Beauty and the Beast, Murdoch Mysteries, Private Eye, as well as the short films Moment 91 and Little Larry. She is working on a new series called The Murders, which stars Jessica Lucas, Dylan Bruce, and Terry Chen. It premiered this past Monday on City TV. This is my conversation with director Jill Carter.
Okay. Jill Carter, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, you are directing the new series, The Murders, with Jessica Lucas and Dylan Bruce. How did you come aboard this project as a director?
Well, I have a really good agent who pestered the showrunner and the producers, and they eventually said, yes, okay, we'll look at your client, and because it was a pilot, it was a little more involved than normal in the fact that, you know, obviously normally you either just get hired because people know your work, or you know, sometimes you'll meet producers and networks and studio executives as well before you get hired, but generally you don't have to talk as much about your ideas about a show before that happens. So in this case, I was just finishing up a movie, and my agent sent me all the information she could send me, like the Bible and the script, and I did my homework, read it all, and then I started looking for my own references for the show for inspiration, and then I just let my imagination run wild, and then a few days later I had a meeting with the producers and the showrunner, and the conversation went really well, and we just talked about the show and some ideas and thoughts I had about how I would approach it, and I had questions for them, they had questions for me, and by the end of that call, or I guess about a week later, I found out that they wanted to hire me, but there was one more step that they wanted me to do before they could make it official with Rogers, and that was to have me do what they call a lookbook. So I had 2 weeks to put together basically a visual representation of what I had talked about with them, and then also just used the meeting I had had with them over the phone to take the conversation that we had had together a step further in terms of you know, some of their thoughts and ideas, and then infuse that with the thoughts and ideas that I had, and basically created a visual lookbook for the show in terms of what I would be interested in terms of how we're going to tell the story and the approach I would take. And then I sent it off, and I got the job.
You had mentioned that just before you started, you had just finished a film, and those are two very different animals in terms of the creative process of a director. How do you find that your process changes when you go from one medium to another, if at all?
Well, the film that I was directing was a Hallmark movie, so it wasn't something that I had been a part of from beginning to end. I do have my own projects that I'm developing, but it wasn't anything of that nature. So it's not that dissimilar to directing a television show or a pilot, for that matter. More probably a pilot, in the fact that, you know, when you're directing a movie, you have a lot more say in the creative process, in terms of who you hire and what you want to do aesthetically. Obviously, Hallmark is a certain type of project because they have a very distinct style and look already, so you have less freedom in that respect. You know, I had a lot of freedom with the murders. It was, you know, an amazing experience. Because as a director, it was my first time since my own shorts and since I'd been directing, you know, for hire, that I had been able to be that involved in a project from the beginning. So I wasn't obviously part of the development process, but once I came on board, Damon Vignali, the showrunner, and Muse, the producers, and Rogers as well, although they were less involved in the day-to-day conversation, but they were very supportive. Everybody was just really excited and open and interested in a collaboration, and I felt very much like I had a voice and I was supported in my decision you know, how I wanted to tell the story, and we all were very much on the same page about that. So it was a really wonderful experience to be able to be working with a group of people who you felt very comfortable with and connected to in terms of not only as a colleague, but also as creators. And we all just had a very similar vision to the story or to telling the murders, and you know, just really were interested in making the most dynamic and engaging homicide detective series.
I know you directed half of the episodes this season, and given that it is an episodic, how involved were you in the overall arc of the season?
In the writing element, or being able to give notes from that perspective, not very. Obviously, in my episodes, I had, you know, comments about the episodes that I was doing. But in terms of visually being able to talk to the other directors that were on board and creating a tone and a style for the show, I was quite involved. That was sort of the nice thing about being a director that got to do half the season, and also because I bookended the show, I did the first two and the last two. That gave it a very nice symmetry, and I was able to share with the other directors the lookbook and talk to them about what the cinematographer and I had found when we were shooting the first two episodes. Because we block shot the episode, so we shot two at a time. You know, we had some very specific styles and choices for framing that we were looking to do in color palettes and stuff like that. And I was able to talk to the other directors about here's the overall vision that we have been talking about and we want to lean into. And then from there, what we learned as we were doing it. And so what was working and what wasn't working and what we really wanted to highlight. Obviously both the other two directors had their own ideas in terms of, you know, when you are working on a television show and especially when it's new, obviously you're going to, or just any episodic television show that you're going to do, part of your job is to obviously stay within the tone and the style that the show is, but then how do you infuse your own voice into that? And so that was important to let them, you know, find their way as well, but also give them the sort of roadmap as to what we had established and what we were looking to maintain as a look overall for the show.
Is each episode a very different experience, or do you find that there's an element of similarity, but going from one episode to the next, how unique would you say each time you direct is?
It's hard to be specific from each episode because we did block shooting, so we shot two together, and so some days you are literally shooting two episodes on that day. The pilot, I can speak to the sort of two blocks. I would say that there's definitely similarities, obviously, but there were certainly some differences, you know, at the beginning, because I had the luxury of directing the beginning and the end. In the beginning, we had, our show was shot all on location. We didn't have any studio. The only kind of semi-studio we had was the police station. And it was really important to find a police station for both Damon and I that looked different and unique compared to most TV police stations that you see. We wanted to push the envelope in that respect. And we found a great location that was downtown Vancouver on Georgia Street. But as a consequence, it meant that a lot of the other stuff we had to shoot was out, in other areas of, like, less downtown, like out in Abbotsford or Maple Ridge and stuff like that. And also it meant that, you know, the show as a whole, although we did have that one location that was, like, a repeat location, all the other locations were very specific to the episodes and what the stories dictated. So that is great because I think it makes it very, very interesting visually and very grounded because it feels more real. But at the same time, it can be tricky because in the first block, we had a lot of locations. So I ended up taking a day from my last block and moving it to my first block so that we had one extra day to shoot that block of episodes. So by the time we got to the last block, you know, we had shot six episodes at that point, and Canadian television isn't made on a huge budget. So it was definitely tricky from that perspective because the two shows I was doing, the season finale, and we had a really interesting episode that's a hostage-taking episode in the second-last episode. So they were big episodes unto themselves, but we had even less time to do them, and we had one less day. So from that perspective, it was tricky, and they were both, you know, the two blocks were very different. And obviously, each episode has its own challenges in terms of storytelling and you know, what the points or the ideas that you're trying to get across and whatever the locations are or, you know, specific to that certain story, you're going to have challenges within that. But I would say the biggest challenge just overall or the biggest difference between the first block and the last block was essentially the amount of time that we had to shoot each one.
Do you, especially on a show like this where there's a lot of action and it's very heavily paced, do you enjoy shooting on location? Does that bring a unique feel to a show like this, would you say?
mean, I think location shooting, although sometimes presents challenges because sometimes you end up finding locations that are tiny. And as you know, film crews are not small, and there's a lot of equipment and people that have to fit in a certain space. So that can sometimes present challenges in terms of, you know, how, where you can place a camera, or, you know, the logistics of how the lights can be set up, or what you do. But that just opens up, like, opportunities to be creative in a way, because you have a certain area that you're playing in. And so, you know, if you're on a studio and you have a set that's built, you can move a wall, and, you know, especially in the beginning when you're creating a set, you can sort of change things as you go along if you need to, or create the space that you really want to live in. Whereas if you're on location, it's very specific. You can't just knock down someone's wall. You have to play within the space that you've found or chosen. But I think that gives authenticity to the look of the show and the feel of the show, because you're in real spaces, and also just presents, you know, positive and sometimes negative challenges to filming. But they're all interesting challenges in the fact that, you know, it just, you just find a different way to do it than maybe you had originally imagined when you didn't know the space that you were playing with. But I like it. I like being on location. I think it's fun, and I think it definitely has a more authentic feel to what you're seeing on television.
Episodics, and specifically, I think, you know, police-based procedurals are one of the oldest forms of television. Why do you think that formula works so well, and, you know, people keep watching these types of shows year after year?
I think because, you know, inherently in police work, there's drama. You have, you know, potentially or fundamentally, I guess, good and bad. Obviously, there's a lot of gray, and I think it presents challenges, you know, as human beings, you know, life can be challenging. And so when you're watching people making choices, and even if it's not a choice that you've ever been presented with, maybe you can find some commonality in the way that they have to deal with a situation, or maybe, you know, it gives you a new perspective and outlook on a person's position and a choice that someone made that may not be a good choice, but it gives you a greater understanding as to why someone might have made a choice that they ended up making that got them into trouble. But, you know, it gives you a fresh perspective on it. I also think, you know, people want escapism too, and there's something to be said for just watching something that's totally not related to your life, and that you can just lose yourself in a dramatic story for an hour and be engaged by. And there's also, like, a lot of elements to police work, so, you know, piecing things together, so it's interesting to watch. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of different types of approaches that you can take in terms of what you're wanting to feed your soul with in that particular evening. I think people can, you know, find a lot of ways to sort of connect with a police procedural in ways that maybe, you know, a straight up comedy or romantic comedy or drama, sometimes you don't necessarily get all of those perspectives. Yeah.
You know, it strikes me in this new era, or this era that we're in Hollywood, where people are talking about diversity, the 4% pledge, you know, 50% female directors. It strikes me that television has always been a place that has been much more equal in proportion in terms of female directors than Hollywood and big films have. Why do you think that is, and what is your perspective on where we are right now in terms of diversification?
I actually don't agree that television is doing that I think they're doing it now, but I don't think they did it then, or have been doing it for years. I mean, not to say that there weren't female directors, obviously there were, but I could count on one hand the number of successful Canadian female directors that I know. And I definitely think that's changing. I think there's a lot more women being brought into the fold. So I think that's obviously happy about it. But, you know, I think it's taken a long time to get there. But I think it's obviously it's positive. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of people talk about representation in terms of being able to see themselves on screen and seeing people like themselves tell stories. And I do think that that's important. You know, I've never really thought of myself as like a female director per se. I just think of myself as a director. And I think that that's probably a healthy thing to do. I don't know that we need to sort of draw those lines. But at the end of the day, the lines are being drawn, and it is important to have representation for both men and women and, you know, people of all walks of life and diverse cultures. I think it's really important. And at the end of the day, we're all human beings, and we all want the same things for ourselves and our families and friends. So I feel like, you know, a good story is a good story. So it's important that we show that, you know, the humanity and the ability for women to tell those stories as well, and for people of other cultures to be able to share their experiences, because, you know, we could probably all find something that we relate to in someone else's story. And I think that's important that we share those ideas. And, you know, at the end of the day, women make up half the society, and our voices should be heard as well. I think it's especially, you know, when you're projecting certain images out into the world about how we're seen, or the ideas of femininity, or things, ideas that are very specific to women, have always been, in some ways, especially in film and television, told by men, or a lot, often have been told by men. And I find it curious, like, even if you look at a lot of romantic comedies that are specifically geared towards women, it's usually men directing them, and I find that odd. Not to say that men don't like romance and don't have something to say on that subject. Obviously, they do, but I think it's a place where, certainly in film, it's a place that I think more women could be a part of, because usually those stories are at least marketed towards women. So I think it's really great that all of these, you know, opportunities are starting and continuing to happen for a diversity and women in our industry. It's important.
Well, the show is The Murders, and it launches on March 25th, starring Jessica Lucas and Dylan Bruce. Jill Carter, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Alrighty, have a good day.
You too.
Cheers.
Thanks so much, Dan.
That was my conversation with director Jill Carter. She has directed episodes of the new TV series The Murders, which airs on CDTV Mondays at 9 o'clock, but be sure to check your local listings. My next guest has been working in factual series and documentary for 20 years and earned her chops as a journalist working for the prestigious investigative programs at CBC, and has directed three documentaries for The Nature of Things. She's also helped to create and helm top factual shows such as Canadian Pickers, Still Standing, and Buy It, Fix It, Sell It. In addition to that, she also creates and directs digital comedy series for Just for Laughs in the CW every summer at the Montreal Comedy Festival, working with some of the top stand-up comics in her world. She's in the process of making the move to scripted television, where she's directing both comedy and drama series content. She has a feature documentary coming out, which premieres tonight, and it's called Met While Incarcerated, and it follows the phenomenon, I guess you could call it, of the prison wife. In this film particularly, it follows three couples. One is a army vet who became pen pals with a prisoner. One is an indigenous lady whose husband is getting out of prison after many, many years. And the third is a teacher and talks about her partner in prison as well. It's a very interesting concept, and she talks about how she initially came across it while on a dating website. It also features the music of the great Jada Kelly, who has been a guest on Endeavors about 3 years ago. This is Catherine Legg. Here is our conversation.
Catherine Legg, hello, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So, you have a new documentary out, Met While Incarcerated. And I understand you sort of stumbled onto these women by accident, but what first intrigued you about the life, the so-called prison wife?
Well, I suppose stumbling upon it because I was casting for a TV show I was working on, and I was looking for cast for a home renovation show, and I typed into Google sexy carpenter, good sense of humor, and up came this prison pen pal dating site. And I looked at it, and here are these photos of buff men with their profiles, and they would have beside their name, you know, first degree murder times three. And it was just this incredible world that I never, you know, knew existed. And I started reading the profiles and, of course, thinking, who are the women who would be interested in a man like this?
I think it was Journey that says, oh, you know, when people find out I'm a prison wife and they look at me, they do get a stereotype. Covering, you know, all their stories. Is that a fair thing to say? Is there a stereotype about the type of person that becomes a prison wife, or do you find that that is largely a myth?
I think that there are people who fit the stereotype, and that's what most of the prison wives say, that they would, you know, run the gamut if you were just to look at the general population of women who go for everything from, you know, the bad boy to those who don't. So there's definitely, you know, people who do write to Paul Bernardo or who write to Nicholas Cruz, and there's kind of a groupie factor, who, and even Michael, one of our characters who's in the film and he's on death row, said you get a group of women who write to you just because you're on death row, and they're crazy. So those people exist, but that's not who this film's about. The film's about regular women, and I picked even women who are successful and influential in their peer groups and in their work and in their families.
And I'm curious, you know, because another sort of, I guess, myth or stereotype we hear about people in prison is the religious factor. And I know a couple of the women in the film are quite religious, specifically Journey. Do you think that has anything to do with it at all?
I think in some ways, you know, there is a factor of, you know, that there a lot of the women are religious. A lot of women in America are religious. So, and these women, in many ways, have to face a situation that is, you know, confront hopelessness all the time. And so I think a lot of the women, the prison wives I've met, you know, rely on their faith and maybe even lean into it. I know that Journey has in the time that she's been together with Ben. So, and there's an element, you know, of understanding and forgiveness. And, but even more than that, I would say that the women that I have met have had complex lives. They've traveled, you know, Journey was in the military. She talked about going to war and facing an enemy and then discovering that her enemy wasn't who she thought they were. So I think, you know, social workers, nurses, teachers, people who've had experience with the breadth of humanity is kind of more a commonality amongst the women that I met, but many of them are faithful.
And do you think that, going back to the groupie factor, is it also that these men that these women meet are, their lifestyles are a complete 180 from what they're used to, and that's part of the appeal for them?
For the groupies, you mean?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I think for the groupies, they're just people who want attention from their friends. You know, they're people who would, you know, get attention in many different ways, and they just think it's cool, you know, to say that they've communicated with someone who is on death row or with a murderer. And there's, you know, sites where people follow serial killers and they trade their art and their letters, and it's all very weird. And I think that we automatically make an assumption that these are the same thing, and they're not.
You mentioned that you came across this on a what was essentially a prison dating website, and I'm curious for you is how you think this age of technology that we're living in, how has that enhanced or changed the way these types of people can communicate with each other on the outside versus the inside?
It's interesting because, you know, there's always been people who've written to people in prison, and pen pal relationships, you know, go way back. What's happened with these internet sites is that, you know, it's much more like, it looks more like a dating site, and you have pictures and profiles and lists of thousands of people in prison, and they do get letters from all over the world. So even though the men don't have access to the internet, but the men who are in prison, they have to write an old-fashioned letter and send photos via snail mail to get on the website, and they can't check, you know, their profile or anything like that. They still have to communicate the old-fashioned way. But they do have a wider reach out to the world. And, you know, Ben, who is one of the characters in the film, talks about himself early on, and many men that he knows, they're writing to, you know, dozens of women. And there are players, even in prison, and they want to meet women and get pictures from them and get them to send them money and help them pass the time, really. So that happens. You know, those people are out there, and definitely, you know, there are women who think they're the only one.
Do you think that there, and this again, maybe another stereotype, which is sort of the theme, I guess, is there something old school romantic about receiving a letter from a man or from an admirer?
There's something very old school romantic about a lot of it. And a lot of that happens early on. And, you know, all of the women I've talked to have a box of letters they'll show to you, and the early letters, you know, handwritten with a lot of pictures, or, you know, sometimes the men will get someone they know who's an artist to draw something. And it's very sweet and charming and romantic because they can't send other gifts. And the letters are very thoughtful. Most of the men that I've talked to who are in prison, who've been in there for a long time, they don't communicate in the fast, sort of short and more surface way that we do now. They're very deep communicators. They're very thoughtful. They're very self-reflective. They're good at expressing themselves. They have to be. And so I think there is something really romantic about it early on, and that's what captivates many women. And in some ways, you know, the forbidden nature of it and all of those things, even prison itself is interesting. I like to talk to, you know, the men about what their life is like in there, and And a lot of the women who are attracted to it are just curious people interested in the breadth of humanity. So that's definitely part of it. In many ways, the romance for some of the couples wears off when it starts to become a real relationship, like all relationships, and kind of that honeymoon period is over and you're in a relationship with a person who isn't there for you daily, financially, can't be there to help you with, you know, life's load every day. And so that's why some of them don't last.
What did you find you learned about the men who are and the prisoners who are in this type of relationship situation? Is there something specific, like some, other than the fact that they're in prison, but is there some type of specific men that you feel that the women are attracted to?
In general, the men that I've spoken to are all, as I say, very good communicators. They're very thoughtful. They listen, and that's something that, you know, they've learned, and really, it does them well in prison to be good communicators. Ben said to me one time, you know, I have 20 seconds when I meet someone inside to assess who they are, what they're about, what they want from me, and how I'm going to deal with them. So the men are very quick in the way that they understand others. And I think, you know, that in general, the men that I spoke to were people who were very reflective and thoughtful and honest about their crimes. No one was saying, I didn't do this, I got railroaded. While that's true of some people, you know, it wasn't of these men. They admit their guilt. They're very sorry for their crimes. They are working every day to change their lives. And in many ways, you know, that's the most that they can do. They're giving their life to prison for the crimes they've committed, and also they're trying to change themselves and come out and be a better person. So that was very common of the men that I spoke to.
In terms of the actual process and style of filmmaking, I know a lot of this was filmed, I think, 2016, 2017, but overall, how long would you say this journey has taken you?
Well, the journey started really 4 years ago, and it started with the idea and then meeting the people. You know, I've been a journalist and a storyteller for more than 20 years, and this one took a long time because it's a very secret world. Finding the people that I found was extremely challenging. Gaining their trust, getting to know their stories, dealing with the prison system and all of the obstacles with that. So just actually building the story and the research and understanding it took probably, you know, 3 years of that. And then, you know, of course, putting together the financing for a documentary is a story of its own. But I had the support of documentary channel right off the bat, and then it took me, you know, a good 2 years to get all of the financing together. So the actual making of the film took about 8 months from shooting everything to editing it.
What made these three couples that you follow in the film, what made them the right people for this story?
I had, you know, dozens of stories to choose from and so many good characters and so many more stories to tell that we're going to have on our website. These ones, I wanted to choose people who were at a pivotal point in their relationship and follow it through to see what happened, because a lot of the relationships don't last, or you come in at, you know, it's a lot of them are extremely boring, just like our relationships. You go for months and months and nothing happens, but when something happens in a prison wife's relationship, it's big. So I wanted to pick the big moments, and I chose Journey because she and Ben were getting married, and she had a family that was extremely Christian and completely against it because it's her fourth marriage. Then I chose Angela and Michael because Michael's on death row and Louisiana's currently debating, you know, if they're going to start executing people again or they're going to abolish the death penalty. And I chose Sunny and Brenda because every prison wife dreams of homecoming. And Sonny in the film is coming home after 31 years of being in prison. And I thought, you know, there's no bigger moment than that.
There's always a challenge or a debate for a documentary filmmaker about how much narration they do, how much of an outside voice they want to have present in the film. And I know yours comes up a little bit throughout the film. What was that conversation like, that internal conversation like with yourself? How much do I want to include this voiceover in the overall storytelling process?
I'm really glad that you asked about this because it was a huge part of making the film for me. And I traditionally would not put voiceover in a film, but I had this struggle with, in so many ways of telling the story, because I wanted the audience to get to where I was with these people, and it's impossible to do that in 78 minutes when it took me several years. So I was trying to really bridge the gap between complete skepticism, these women are crazy, to really understanding the relationship in a thoughtful and deep and meaningful way. And I was actually listening to the podcast S-Town, and it changed my life and changed, you know, my thinking as a storyteller, because, you know, for those who've listened to it, the story starts out being one thing and it becomes another. And I think that it's become such a compelling story because, you know, as a journalist, that happens to us all the time. As a filmmaker, you know, the story that happened isn't the one you always set out to do. And I wanted to be able to be a bridge. I also used music and used animation to really try to get people to jump from one place to another emotionally and psychologically and intellectually very quickly.
I wanted to pick up on the music because I must say I love the score that is in this film. I think it adds a whole other layer of emotion and of storytelling. But picking the music for a project, specifically a documentary and a story that has so much going on like this, what goes into that process for you?
Well, this for me was one of the biggest, you know, artistically and creatively speaking, pinnacle of my career. And I couldn't be more happy with the collaboration that I have with Jada Kelly, who's the composer, and the people who worked alongside her and the producers, who every person that I came to and said, I want to tell a love story and I need, you know, to get there fast, they brought their artistry. And so I approached Jada because I was a fan of her music. And I said, this is the topic I'm working with. It's very challenging, especially, you know, all of us being women on the team and dealing with this subject at the height of the Me Too movement when we're not in a very forgiving place. I wanted people to still understand this love. And there's no, you know, shorthand better for that than music. And Jada actually wrote one song specifically for the film, and she was in Nashville writing it, and she also had another song she had just written, and it worked perfectly with the film, and it was almost kind of magical. And then I had said to her, you know, I'm really interested in the song Amazing Grace because it's what the film is all about, but I want kind of this other version. And I played her this Willie Nelson version of the song that's very dark, and it's done in the minor key, and I played it for her and said, I feel like this song might work for the film. So she was in Nashville working and songwriting, and she got in touch with a producer there, who David Kalmuski, and he's with Addiction Sound, a big studio, a famous one. And she said, you know, I have this film and the producer wants me to work with the song Amazing Grace, and he listened to her and he listened to the minor key version that she recorded just on her acoustic guitar, and he said, I have an idea. And we actually, you know, all came together in Nashville about a week later and had this amazing recording session that I have a mini film on, making that recording of Amazing Grace. And it was his, you know, mind behind it to have this time traveling version, and he gathered together these famous Nashville session players, and we recorded it. He recorded it on a 1938 record cutter, straight to vinyl, and it was just one of the coolest things, the most amazing experiences I'd ever had.
I'm just
the music, in a sense, is huge to the film.
I'm just curious, is in the course of your research and making this film, whether you came across a prison husband at all, and if that was any ever part of the consideration for making this film.
I did come across a few prison husbands. They're not, and they're definitely out there, but they aren't as much part of the social groups. I know that, they have a lot of the same struggles. There's also prison husbands who are same-sex couples. So, you know, their relationships run the gamut, just like everyone's outside. So definitely they're there, have very similar themes and thoughts. And so it wasn't something that I was going to go to just because I'd, you know, really centered on the stories that I did specifically by their circumstances.
What do you want people who watch this film to take away and maybe learn about this dynamic?
I guess I want people to look a little harder at things. I want them to, not jump to the stereotype and to imagine that, you know, they've decided about who someone is because of who they love. That's one thing, because, you know, I interviewed a mother who was a fantastic mother, and her son committed a murder and is serving a life sentence in Canada. And it touched me so deeply that, you know, her love is her love for him. She said, love isn't a tap. You don't turn it off and on. And I felt that for these women, the stigma that they face, the stereotyping, many of them have to live their lives in secret, keep their relationships secret, and they've committed no crime. Most of them have never even had a parking ticket, you know, the ones I spoke to, let alone imagined that this would be their world. They don't excuse these crimes, neither do the men. We're not discounting the victims as being at the center of all of this, and that there's people deeply hurt by these men. But I would say that for people who really work at it and want to change their life, they deserve a second chance at love. And I think that we need to allow them that, if it's even in our power to give it. But at the very least, it's in our power to understand them. And I think that we should consider that. And I think people should realize there isn't the big difference between us and them that we've always imagined there to be.
Well, the film is Met While Incarcerated, and it premieres Sunday, March 31st at 9 p.m. on CBC's documentary channel. Catherine Legge, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with Catherine Legge. Her documentary is Met While Incarcerated, and it premieres tonight on the CBC documentary channel. That's it for the show today. My sincere thanks to both Catherine Legge and to Jill Carter. Stay tuned for Wednesday's episode when I feature actor and comedian Dave Sheridan. You might know him best as Officer Doofy from Scary Movie. In the future, we'll also have an upcoming interview with Patricia Velasquez and Kevin Hearn of the Bare Naked Ladies. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.